for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on vacation. The United States and China wrapped up 2 days of high-level talks in Washington yesterday. They pledged to fight climate change, continue to address the world's financial crisis, and deal with the nuclear ambitions of Iran and North Korea. Joining me in the studio to discuss what was accomplished and what challenges lie ahead, Georgetown University professor Albert Keitel, Stephen Clemens with the New America Foundation, and Stapleton Roy with the Woodrow Wilson International Center. He is a former U.S. ambassador to Beijing. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks, Susan.
Thanks. Great to be here.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. Our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, Stapleton Roy, you were at a dinner last night that concluded these 2 days of talks between U.S. and Chinese leaders. What happened at the dinner? What struck you?
The tone of the dinner was uniformly upbeat. And as you know, this is the continuation of the dialogue we've had with China for the last two-plus years. But this was a new format, and it was a new administration. And this administration differs from every previous American administration. It's gotten off on a good start in its relationship with China. And the dinner last night reflected that. The tone was uniformly upbeat, and I've never been in a situation where there has been an absence of references to friction points.
You know, Steve Clemens, also notable that the Chinese officials, who often present very scripted remarks, seem to be speaking extemporaneously.
Yes, they spoke off the cuff. They gave personal stories in vignettes, shared comments about their personal relationships with, talking about Hillary Clinton, about bringing pictures of grandkids and children to these events so that they're focused on the future. Vice Premier of the State Council, Wang Jishan, talked about knowing Timothy Geithner's father years ago, who was the head of the Ford Foundation China program there. And so it was a very, very unusual in that sense. And I think Stapleton Roy is absolutely right. It was very strange for me because I think it was so much a love fest that perhaps they overdid it, because there was not even a veiled reference to human rights concerns or to currency questions or questions about manufacturing. It just, all of that was absent. And it was, I think, that the high point of the evening, the most tense moment, was when one of the Chinese leaders mentioned, he says, "You Americans, don't lose any sleep over China." And then there was sort of a nervous chuckle in the room. And that was the tense point of the evening. And everything else was, you know, was lovey-dovey.
Albert Keitel, when you were a Bush administration official in the Treasury Department, you were instrumental in setting up this series of meetings that have been held. How was this different from the ones that you were involved with during the Bush administration?
Well, we had an effort to set up one because early in the Bush administration, and I was new to it, there was a problem of getting results from high up in the Chinese government. And so it really came from the U.S. Trade Representative's office and from the Commerce Department saying, look, we need some more traction at the top. And we began to try to move on what we all knew was the important difference between our systems. Our secretaries are members of our cabinet. Their ministers are not. Their ministers report to members of their cabinet. So we needed to get a contact at the very high level among this sort of management group that runs China from the government side called the State Council. And Commerce Department really finally made the breakthrough with their JCCT, the Joint Committee on Commerce and Trade, and they got Wu Yi, who was in the State Council, to be their counterpart at a first meeting, and then she eventually became Secretary Paulson's counterpart. So it was a really necessary and needed evolution in our relationship. And I, though, if I comment on what happened at the banquet last night, I think it's not surprising, because if we worry about the laundry list of kinds of issues that should be big and important, we're forgetting that one is really overarchingly critical right now, and that's the state of the world economy. And so there, China and the United States have very different roles to play. They've been put in different positions, sometimes by different people. But this is the real problem that we face right now, and perhaps hopefully only for the next 6 months, for a year. But if we don't get that right, a lot of other stuff doesn't matter.
Stapleton Roy, were there concrete accomplishments from these 2 days of meetings?
None was mentioned last night. And the purpose of the strategic dialogue is not to produce concrete, a laundry list of accomplishments. It really is designed to focus on the longer range view of where the relationship is heading and to touch on the key points. I'd make one corrective, Steve. Steve is right that there were friction points were basically not there, but I do believe that Secretary Clinton referred to the fact that she had raised Xinjiang. So I think there was...
And Xinjiang is...
Xinjiang is the western province of China, the autonomous region where the Uyghurs and the Han Chinese have had some recent violent clashes. So there's no question that in the private sessions, some of the difficult issues in the relationship were touched on, but they were not raised in any of the remarks at the dinner last night, with the one exception of this brief reference to the human rights concerns.
Now, I read this morning that a Chinese official praised the United States for its moderate approach to the human rights issues, including the ones involving the Uyghurs. And I wonder, does that signal that the United States is really downplaying human rights with China now because we have other interests, economic interests, dealing with North Korea and so on?
Let me comment on that, if I may, because I was ambassador in China at a time when the human rights issues were front and center in our relationship. The answer is, being aggressive on human rights issues does not produce better results on human rights than being able to engage in sensible dialogue with the other country so that they, in a sense, want to try to accommodate themselves to your views on the issues. So I don't think that a moderate approach reflects a diminishing of importance to the issue.
We saw that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was co-hosting this 2 days of meetings with the Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. Now, that's a change from the Bush administration, and that was a result of some internal domestic politics. Steve Clements, what happened?
Well, I think that from the very outset, Hillary Clinton and her team have wanted to have a piece of this action. In fact, I was at James Steinberg, the Deputy Secretary of State's confirmation hearings, where Jim was asked about being involved not only with the typical NSC issues, but being involved with the plate of NEC issues, and very specifically mentioning China. So this has been part of the game plan to bring that in. And I think it's been tough for Treasury and State to sort out this dual-headed approach. But on the domestic side, which I don't know, I just know that the State Department is upgrading its role and place in this. I think that they've largely done a very good job. You have to remember, Hillary Clinton admonished George Bush and encouraged George Bush not to go to the opening ceremonies of the Olympic Games during the campaign. And I had written at the time that I thought this was very unpresidential, because you have to think about climate change, whether you're concerned about human rights, the global economy. You need China in all of these issues. And then so to antagonize the Chinese over a very important sort of nationally psychologically reifying event doesn't solve the problems in Tibet, nor does it solve Darfur. And you probably have to pay a higher cost then for all of the other things. So she's completely remade herself and reasserted the State Department's role and relevance in one of the key national security foreign policy issues of our time.
Well, Bert Keitel, is there any downside to having state play a role in this instead of having it be really the domain of the Treasury Department?
Oh, absolutely not. No, it's a huge improvement. And I think it's a natural evolution, because what happened once we got a relationship, a working relationship, not just an audience on a platform, which is what often happens, once we had a working relationship between a senior member, in fact, a vice premier of the Chinese government, a member of its cabinet, with top members of our cabinet, all kinds of issues began to funnel through that relationship between Paulson and Wang Yi. And some, you know, there would be special trips and things that involved not economic, perhaps some message about North Korea or some other issue that was quite hot. And so it made a lot of sense that this, and I think there was some envy on the part of other U.S. departments, defense in particular, but also state. And so to broaden it is really the right direction. We need more, not fewer or narrower relationships at that very high level, because our governments are arranged so differently that the individual counterparts aren't often the right counterparts. And you need an umbrella that says, all right, you three over here, you get together with those four over there and you work on this problem. And then you get some results. So it really provides that kind of connectivity that is so important.
Well, your successors at the Treasury Department who are now there, do you think they agreed with you, or do you think there was a little resistance to giving up some of this territory?
Oh, I think there was, you know, a lot of good humor and snickering, but they realized that there are a lot of issues that they can't deal. I mean, I think my understanding is that the Chinese sent a senior colonel this time. So you're moving also into what might be military-to-military relations. I mean, this is not Treasury issue. And yet there are a lot of things that do intersect. For example, climate change. That involves carbon caps. It involves trade and energy and the globalization of a whole range of issues and also potentially steps to counter the impact of global warming. These are economic and strategic issues, so it really needs to be under one roof.
Our phone lines are open. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. Steve Clemens.
I think one of the important things to think about, what we see going on is a if I can use the term, complexification of the U.S.-China relationship, which I think is absolutely necessary. And it goes back to Stapleton Roy's excellent comment about the framework to deal with human rights and other issues. You need to think about the broader context. I worked in the Senate years ago when we used to have a sort of eggs all in one basket approach to dealing with China, and so that if things didn't go well, we would have a vote each year, frankly, on trade relations that would disrupt the entire thing. And what I think now is a serious upgrade. Barack Obama said the other day that the U.S.-China bilateral relationship is as important as any other bilateral relationship. What really was clear last night at the dinner is it's a step far beyond that, that U.S.-China relations are the most important bilateral relationship in the world. And you saw it in the instructions that Hu Jintao and Barack Obama very clearly gave their teams to essentially push beneath all of these other complex issues. My view is you're not going to have a mature U.S.-China relationship unless you can really bring in those trouble spots in the broader context and not run away from them, even at a gala dinner at the Ritz-Carlton.
Stapleton Roy, do you agree that the U.S.-China relationship is now the most important relationship the United States has with another country?
If you ask me my favorite color, I always answer, I don't deal in just one. There are colors I like, there are others I don't. I think that it unquestionably is among the most important relationships. But for diplomatic reasons, I would say it's as important as any other relationship in the world.
And that's a very diplomatic answer. We're going to take a short break. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll go to the phones. We'll read your comments by email. Give us a call. Stay with us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Stapleton Roy, a former U.S. ambassador to China, Indonesia, and Singapore. And Stephen Clemens, he's director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. And Bert Keitel, he's former acting director of the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of East Asian Affairs. He now teaches a course on China's economy at Georgetown University. You know, we were talking just before the break about whether the U.S.-Chinese relationship is, in fact, the most important relationship the United States has in the world. What do you think, Bert Keitel?
Well, I don't think you can say that's true right now. China gets so much attention because it has the potential to grow rapidly. I also did a thesis at one point on the European coal and steel community, and the fact that Europe is not getting its act together leaves a sort of a vacuum or a void in that part of the world where we might have a very important partner. So the world is in flux, and China has an economic future, which if it comes out of this crisis well and continues to grow and mature in its market systems, will eventually allow it to become a larger commercial power than the United States. It's that promise of China's scale on the global economy that makes it so important today, and we need to be ready for when China approaches us from that perspective. It'll be a different world.
When it comes to the economy, China expressed great concern in the past 2 days about the U.S. deficit and debt. Why is this of such concern to China, Steve?
Well, because I think when they're holding the world's largest currency reserves, the largest stash of dollars in the world, they are invested deeply in the prospects for the American economy. And so when they see governments continue to spend beyond their means, for them that means inflation, it means devaluation of the dollar, it means a kind of economic recklessness that they are joined at the hip with, and I think anyone joined at the hip with that would be worried about it. They are in a very complex problem where the United States is very clearly, we used to criticize the Chinese for, exporting toxic products around the world. To some degree, the United States exported toxic financial products to the rest of the world. And in that, we helped precipitate a global crisis that, to some degree, that earthquake opened up a very deep earthquake that has shown what these imbalances between China and the United States are all about. The one substantive part of last night's dinner was Tim Geithner essentially laying out that the United States was agreeing in principle to various measures to rein in our spending, to promote savings in the U.S. economy, to get to a healthier, more grounded kind of economic growth, because we're probably not going to go back to a period of time where Americans fuel global growth by consuming at levels far beyond their means. We're going to go into a different phase. China is dependent on that manic consumerism right now for its growth. It has to rewire itself to be able to develop demand and grow services abroad. And so we're joined together, but we both have to mutually commit to behaviors that to some degree decrease that dysfunctional economic sort of mutual going over the cliff, if you will.
Bert Keitel.
Well, I think Steve is right that the U.S., in a sense, exported a lot of its financial problems to the rest of the world, and they had to reply. I think in China's case, though, it has a domestic constituency that is blaming it for perhaps mismanaging its currency and by putting them too much in the U.S. Denominated instruments. The Chinese reserves are so large, I think, because their money supply is so large. This is a large economy in terms of its money supply. Compared to its money supply, its reserves aren't very large, say, compared to Singapore, for sure, and South Korea. But the approach that China has taken is to try to reply to this expansion that Steve was just talking about. Before 2004, China had balanced global trade, and it relied on a normal growth in the U.S. economy and a normal trade relationship, but it wasn't really export dependent. And the export surge that came after 2004, fueled, as Steve implies, and I think that's right, by the gross expansion in American buying power, that really overheated their economy. We, in a sense, exported inflation to China. And when they tried to deal with that, they slowed their own imports, cut machinery imports to try to cut inflation, and their trade surplus increased. So we're not as much joined at the hip, I don't think, as we're joined in a normal way, because healthy trade is part of any economy's growth, but not the way Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and so forth are joined to the American economy.
Last fall, China replaced Japan as the U.S. number one foreign creditor. I was reading that about $1 out of $10 in U.S. debt is held by the Chinese now. And, of course, their concerns about the deficit, many Americans would join their concerns about the state of the record-breaking U.S. deficit. Did the Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, indicate that the administration is going to do things they have not yet unveiled, take steps that they haven't talked about yet in order to bring that deficit down?
Not in his remarks last night. But I think the Treasury is very focused on this issue, and I think that they will continue to show imagination and initiative in efforts to try to keep our potential recovery going.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's what China wanted to talk about with the U.S. when it came to the economy. What was the U.S. Request to China about its economy, Steve?
Well, U.S., I think Hillary Clinton and Tim Geithner had different objectives. Hillary Clinton wants a deal on climate change, and one of the deliverables they seem to have gotten was a toothless but nonetheless a memorandum of understanding on climate change, an MOU. That was Hillary's takeaway, her highest priority. Geithner's highest priority was to begin serious discussions with China on both continuing stimulus. And there have been very robust statements from the Chinese that they're going to continue a fiscal expansion package as long as the United States does, and that they will begin to pull back when we begin to pull back. I think that was a deliverable for Geithner. I think the other is to what Americans are going to have difficulty with politically down the road is you have to begin to lay down the framework for looking at what how China can invest and become more involved with returning the American economy to solvency, if you will. You're going to see massive Chinese investment, much like we saw from Japan years ago, come into this country, buy outfits, invest in new firms. I think the renewable energy drive is going to be create incentives for partnerships with Chinese firms. They've got to lay that groundwork because China, Germany, and Japan are the world's three most important surplus nations in the world, and we're on our back as one of the great deficit nations of the world. So that's they're talking about that because it's going to be the Chinese stimulating its economy and driving domestic growth that essentially has to put Americans back to work. I think that's what Geithner is trying to work on.
Well, I think that that's actually a pretty tall order. The Chinese economy still has not reached $5 trillion in GDP. The U.S. is $14 trillion, and the other OECD economies make their industrialized world economy well over $30 trillion. China's still small fry in the world economy, but it is growing very fast. I think the key thing is that both the Chinese and the American administrations are facing a populace that doesn't understand how you get out of a crisis, a financial crisis like this. It takes the kind of thing that we didn't do in the 1930s until we got to World War II. We failed in the 1930s to spend enough because the Congress resisted the increasing budget deficits. So they're on a fine line. They have to stimulate the economy, and both governments know this. But they both have to face domestic criticism that this is dangerous, that this is irresponsible, that we're going to run into inflation. And so you hear them saying, we're ready to do what we have to do if inflation should appear. But let's not forget, this global downturn, a real slump in demand, is a very serious, ugly situation we have today in the world.
We're going to go to the phones now, 1-800-433-8850. We have one caller just before we go to more serious topics who is wondering, what was served for dinner last night?
I think it was surf and turf. But
It was surf and turf, exactly. There was a white fish and a beef, I believe it was.
All right.
You know, I'm on the South Beach diet, so I only looked at the meat portions and ignored everything else.
All right. Let's go to Adam. He's calling us from Syracuse, New York. Adam, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you today?
Good.
Good. I have a comment and a question. I just returned from 5 months in China as an intern with the Joint U.S.-China Cooperative for Clean Energy. And it's an NGO based in Shanghai with an office in Beijing. And they're doing some very interesting things, bringing together politicians from both sides of the Pacific and business executives. So that's just one thing. The question is, what was discussed in terms of intellectual property rights? And I guess I'll take the discussion off the air.
All right, Adam, thanks very much. Intellectual rights, what did you hear about that?
Zero. The truth is that the Dai Bingao, who was the state counselor there last night, said that they discussed everything except Mars and going to the moon. So perhaps it was discussed, but I think as Stapleton Roy has referred to a number of times, the detail of these meetings hasn't made its way out to the public yet. So it's somewhere, I'm sure IPR, particularly with relation to technology investment in China down the road on clean energy issues, is important. I'm sure it was discussed there, but we know none of the details yet.
Adam has been working on the issue of climate change. Now, there was, as Steve said, a memorandum of understanding, but it didn't have any specific emission targets from these two countries, the globe's two biggest emitters of greenhouse gases. Are there signals here, Stapleton Roy, for what will happen at this upcoming meeting in Copenhagen to deal with climate change?
The signal is that the United States and China are trying to find a cooperative approach to this question. This is very difficult. We are the largest developed country in the world, and we polluted a lot in the process of getting there. China's number one priority is rapid growth, and most of its growth has gone into raising the living standards of its people. So this is not a trivial question for them. But to engage in rapid growth, you have to slow it down if you address clean energy as part of that process. That's what China needs to do, but it's not easy for them to do it politically. And that's where the symbiotic relationship between the two of us becomes. China cannot do it if the United States doesn't take serious measures to deal with the issue of clean energy, and we cannot deal with it effectively if China continues to pollute. Both of us recognize this. Both of us favor addressing it, but we want to do it in a painless fashion. There is no painless fashion. So the question is, can we find a mutual level of pain we can both tolerate that will send a signal to the rest of the world that we are serious in addressing this? This is the issue that we're working on as we approach the Copenhagen meeting.
And the problem is in China that reducing emissions is expensive. There are lots of coal-fired power plants in China that have equipment installed. There was a very interesting report on this from MIT last year. But if they use it, it costs them more. And so they're not using it as fully as they would. And the expense of actually installing it is also a significant issue. So the IPR question that Adam has raised becomes relevant. Is China going to be somehow given permission or allowed for a modest cost to be able to replicate on a very large scale the kinds of technology that's needed to reduce emissions? These are very difficult issues, and I think we probably need to get ready also for some mitigation of global warming effects, not focus only on trying to prevent it.
Go ahead, Steve.
I mean, I would just add that, you know, I've just recently returned from China, and in contrast to past visits, I can't overstate how much everyone at every corner of Chinese society, both private sector, public sector, talks about the environmental challenges facing the country. I think everything that was just said is accurate. But you see the Chinese experimenting with and deploying, without an agreement, incredibly important new technologies, natural gas plants, coal plants that are, in fact, more expensive. But it is the number one issue in the minds of most Chinese about what they have to grapple with. If you go to India, I think one of the most important things here, if you go to India, there seems to be a very different sort of general environment about not only roles and responsibilities, but perhaps more serious look at what Copenhagen and environmental deal making there may mean for the country. But with China, you certainly do have arm wrestling over what the terms will be. But the country itself, separate from that, is rushing as fast as it can, and it may not be enough to look at very different ways to sort of price carbon and move carbon in such a way that it can take itself to a different environmental equilibrium, if you will.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls. We're going to read your emails, drshow@wamu.org, or send us a tweet. Let's go to Dan. He's calling us from Norwich, Vermont. Hi, Dan.
Hi. How is everybody this morning?
Good.
Well, thank you.
Good. Listen, I got to disagree vehemently with what's being said by the gentleman, because I think that the Chinese, the reason that they came to the meeting and were sort of feeling very loose and happy and slapping people on the back, is because they went back to their hotel rooms and they said, "We've won. We've won this thing. We're holding $2 trillion of U.S. debt. Any money, any stimulus money that the United States tries to create, we've won this thing." That's what's going on. The Chinese have won the economic war, and it's going to take about 10 years to unfold. The United States is going to be decoupled economically. And I'll take comments off the air. Thanks so much.
All right, Dan, thanks for your call.
You know, to some degree, China, in the eyes of many other nations in the world, is the Google of nations. And America looks something like Xerox or General Motors, you know, a large, well-branded, underperforming asset. And one of the challenges of this strategic and economic dialogue is to see whether there's a credible pathway forward where the United States can go through a workout of its situation and propel itself and get back into a position of global leverage and influence. And so what the caller is saying is you know, looking at this as a zero-sum game. I think that the Chinese themselves, if you spend serious time behind the scenes with leaders, is they're very, very uncomfortable with the notion that they would be a rising hegemonic force that would challenge American global leadership. I think China's real power is rapidly advancing. It is the Google of nations, but it wants the optics of the global order to remain as they have been, and it wants America to stop kicking down the hill of which it was king of the hill. And so the tensions in that relationship are real. I talk to Chinese who can't believe that we have made some of the decisions we have had and undermined our own global influence in the world, because they don't believe they're ready to assume global leadership. So while many people look at it like the caller said, the Chinese themselves at the highest levels don't want to be there yet.
Do you agree with that, Stapleton Roy? What do you think the large-scale Chinese goal is here?
As I mentioned earlier, the Chinese goal is rapid economic development. And China has been remarkably successful, the most successful country in history in raising large numbers of people from poverty in a short period of time. But I don't think you can look at our bilateral relationship with China in terms of winning and losing. The Chinese have come a long way, but when they look around them, they find that there are still much more powerful countries around them, and if they don't manage those relationships properly, they can lose everything that they've gained. And therefore, when you talk to the Chinese, you sense pride in what they've accomplished, but a lot of uncertainty and concern about the fact that they are still a relatively weak country in the world, and that they have a long way to go before they reach the level of development of European countries, for example.
Bert Keitel?
Yeah, I'm delighted that people like Dan and Vermont are going to China and getting experience there, because I think this is really critical to helping America have a broad understanding of the problems China faces. I hope that he got out of Shanghai and went to other parts of China, because there are places where tens of millions of people live in caves. China's per capita output is really under $4,000. The United States is more than 10 times that, at $40,000. So China has an enormous challenge to try to bring its population up, and they want to be able to do that. They have a military that has really no capabilities outside the very limited perimeter of China's borders. And so I think to say that they have won because they have some money in their checking account is an exaggeration.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the conversation that U.S. and Chinese officials had on the topic of North Korea. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A journalist turns to a clinical trial in hopes of curing his diabetes. The risks and benefits of experimental medical treatments. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We have an email from Warren in Arlington, Virginia, who asks, please comment on my feeling that if ever there were an opportunity for China to step up a level in international matters, it would be to really handle North Korea. What was the talk about North Korea, Stapleton Roy, in these 2 days of talks?
North Korea unquestionably was one of the principal topics in the strategic part of the dialogue. That is the one between Secretary Clinton and State Counselor Dai Bing-guo. It's a major, major problem for both countries. We have a common view that our interests will be served and the interests of the Northeast Asia region will be served if the Korean Peninsula is denuclearized. And so we want to have that happen. The problem is we have failed so far in our efforts to do that. The North Koreans have tested twice. We both consider this unacceptable. But we haven't yet found a way of walking this back. So we and the Chinese are consulting extremely closely on this question. I was in China a month ago and participated in conversations on this subject, even though I'm outside the government now, and I knew at that time that this was going to be a principal topic. I think that what the two sides found was that they continue to agree on the immediate measures that need to be taken. And this is implementation of the UN resolution that has put sanctions on North Korea and tightening the squeeze on North Korea. The North Koreans, you notice, have now indicated that they're willing to go back into a bilateral dialogue with the United States. We think the dialogue needs to be broader, but we haven't yet sorted that out. But there is a new element that the North Koreans are now blinking a little bit because of the situation they find themselves in.
Steve Clemens, are there signs that the Chinese are willing to do more now when it comes to addressing the North Korea nuclear issue than they've done in the past?
I was in Beijing when the North Korea nuclear test that recently went off was there, and the American media got it very wrong, thinking that this was somehow a dereliction of duty by China. Chinese leaders were deeply embarrassed, frustrated, and angry at the North Koreans and felt that they'd been left down the road. But that said, China and the United States, while they have similar objectives with North Korea, are not identical. China is willing to patronize, to allow North Korea to extort from it, to engage in behaviors, because it cares mostly about stability. We care about denuclearizing, keeping the peninsula nuclear free, though it's not now. And we care about our security alliances with South Korea and Japan. One friend of mine in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in China said, you know, when it comes down to the bottom line, if we all fail, North Korea will attack your allies, not us. So we need to realize that we're on slightly different pages. But what's happened as a result of that embarrassment China experienced from North Korea is it has toughened its entire stand and gone with us in ways on these UN Security Council resolutions that it previously resisted. And I think that Hillary Clinton, who recently talked about this and talked about not patronizing, not letting North Korea act out like a child and then to get attention. My only counterposition to that is attention can be cheap. When we had Ambassador Chris Hill operating and managing this relationship, people may not agree with everything Hill achieved, but in my view, it was a managed relationship, and we had some minor miracles during that process that I thought were quite good. And then we went into a period where we didn't have anyone in Chris Hill's job. We had Senator Sam Brownback with a long-term hold on our current Assistant Secretary for East Asia, Kurt Campbell. And I think that members of the Congress and Senate need to realize that when they meddle in some of these appointments, that the absence of attention has its own consequences beyond the substance of the problem. And luckily, we're beyond that. And hopefully, as Stape Roy said, we're on the verge of North Korea blinking a little bit and getting a little bit. You know, one thing about North Korea can always be predicted is that it will always take the unpredictable line. And when things are good, it will move bad. When things are bad, it'll eventually move in a positive direction.
Well, I followed Korea very closely at the Treasury, and I actually lived in Korea for a year and a half doing my dissertation, speak quite a bit of Korean. And I'm amazed at, of course, how much North Korea is an anachronism. But I think right now we need to be aware that there is a looming leadership change in North Korea. There's a lot of jockeying for positions there. A lot of that is posturing that show your nationalism and your links to the fatherland and the leadership of the past. So it is quite a fluid, dicey time right now, and it's not, in my mind, a time for us to sort of be thinking the Chinese aren't doing enough and should slam the North Koreans hard. But I'm an economist who has followed this whole region very closely, so maybe I don't have the insights that political and diplomatic specialists do, but I really think this is quite a fluid time.
If I may say, this is what Bert got into, is that one former envoy to North Korea and that whole region shared to me and said, you know, this is a problem all related to Kim Jong-il not being Kim Jong-well. So getting, as many people have criticized the United States for not doing more, I think Barack Obama's underplaying, underreacting was an important strategic choice that I thought was very mature, as opposed to previous presidents that would allow matters of ego and something like this has you know, being driven by domestic calculations within North Korea, that if you get into a tit for tat or back and forth internationally, you can very quickly spiral into dangerous behaviors. So I think Barack Obama has mostly gotten the North Korea thing right, with the exception of not having Kurt Campbell in his job earlier.
What do you think, Ambassador Roy? Do you think that that this has been smart on the administration's part, the way it's handled North Korea?
Yes, I do. I think that reacting sensibly was exactly the way to do it. Why? Because if you say that your behavior is unacceptable, and then it turns out that you don't have any way of actually making it unacceptable, you're simply showing your own impotence. And therefore, screaming loudly about unacceptability was not the right approach. On the other hand, China's approach on this, Steve was absolutely right. The Chinese are furious about North Korean behavior. Their relations with North Korea are very bad. They have North Korea on a tight leash. They're not prepared to chop them off at the neck any more than we would try to do the same thing to one of our neighbors. They're concerned about instability on their border. They are deeply concerned, however, about the implications of what will happen if North Korea gains a real nuclear weapons capability. And therefore, they have supported a very tough sanctions resolution. You find the domestic debate in China on North Korea is completely open. They're talking about secession. There are articles being published in the state-approved press which are critical of China for not being harder on North Korea. This is a different situation from the China-North Korea relationship of a few years ago.
Let's go to Maggie. She's calling us from Bethesda, Maryland. Maggie, thanks for calling us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. My question is whether the panelists think the six-party talks are still the best venue for negotiations with North Korea, and are the Chinese continuing to be satisfied with the U.S.'s role in the six-party talks?
All right. Thanks for your call, Maggie. What do you think?
The answer is the six-party talks is the best forum to deal with it. But unfortunately, the North Koreans have categorically rejected going back to the six-party talks. So the question is, what do you do under these circumstances? There needs to be engagement with North Korea in order to try to explore non-violent options for dealing with the problem. But at the moment, the North Koreans are holding out the possibility of bilateral talks. But the talks involve the fundamental interests of China, of Japan, of South Korea, of Russia. So therefore, if they're not part of the talks, you have a potential for major misunderstandings with other countries who have legitimate interests in the question. So you can't just have bilateral talks. There needs to be a bilateral component, but there needs to be some way of engaging the other parties.
Yes, Steve.
You know, one of the more fun parts of Christopher Hill's diplomatic work with North Korea and the six-party talks, and of course, Chris Hill is now our ambassador to Baghdad, was that the Chinese agreed to set up a multilateral dinner. Condi Rice was headed over to this, and it was one of the points where the six-party talks had stalled, and we would not agree to any bilateral arrangements. And one of the clever things that happened is that the Chinese hosted the Koreans and the Americans and then didn't show up to the dinner. So Chris Hill was left with the North Koreans at a dinner that the Chinese ostensibly hosted. But it was the breakthrough that brought North Korea back into the six-party talk framework. That is the kind of diplomatic flexibility and you know, rabbit out of the hat moves that we sometimes need to deal with, you know, a very complicated power that has nuclear weapons. And you know, we ought not to be all high and mighty about purity in these issues and try to find some way forward. But I completely agree that the six-party talk framework is the only one that can ultimately work for the region.
Keith has been patient. Thanks for holding on, Keith. You're on the air now.
Thank you for taking my call. America has created an economic and military monster by allowing China to devastate our manufacturing base. But China has also opened a Pandora box by allowing its population to enjoy capitalist wealth. With a meltdown in manufacturing and unemployment due to this recession, its whole population could rise up against this communist government. We've already seen major unrest in China.
All right. Keith, thanks very much. Keith is calling us from Palm Coast, Florida. Bert?
Well, I think Keith is right to point out that there may be some social instability that results from the crisis. So far, it's been rather mild. The Xinjiang outbreak fit a kind of a pattern where there were workers that were traveling to another province, and they were a minority in that province and, in fact, seemed to be taking jobs from local Han Chinese in South China. So there was an incident very far from Xinjiang that involved some Xinjiang migrants and claims of rape that were never satisfactorily substantiated. And then those violent actions far from Xinjiang were the reason for actions back home in a retribution against Han Chinese by the Uyghurs. So there is an important possibility here that the economic restructuring, the rapid change, put so many people in difficult relationships with each other that there are going to be outbreaks. There are going to be outbursts of violence, and they need to be managed and handled, and people need to discern who are the criminal elements and who's done what is wrong. But I don't see this as a rising revolution against the regime in China. You get very high marks in terms of citizen satisfaction when foreign polling firms go to China. And you the rapid change and improvement in the standard of living, even now, we've had increases in household income and consumption just in this last year, right through the crisis, gives Chinese a degree of satisfaction that their future will be better than their past. And so I don't share the concern that China's management or difficulties in this crisis will lead to some sort of social revolution.
Steve Clemens.
You know, I am one of those who believes that manufacturing does matter in an economy. And we've, you know, one of the other people stand out at the dinner last night was Robert Rubin. And if you follow the sort of Rubinomics school of economics, it presided to some degree over a period that was okay with the American manufacturing base being gutted somewhat and by a very hyper kind of offshoring to other economies, you know, China and other economies in the region. That doesn't mean that all of it is bad, but it means that it went beyond what I consider to be healthy levels. And right now we see factors that weren't discussed at the dinner. I hope that we eventually do get them. But, you know, I think given the strength of the Chinese economy, we should see a much more significantly higher Chinese yuan. And that helps reduce the level of, you know, implied export subsidy to the United States and get things back on a healthier term. But the Rubin wing of those that were geared towards finance being the be-all is to some degree what we're trying to take ourselves out from and get back to a more balanced kind of economic policy approach that balances finance, balances manufacturing, to some degree asks the question of what should America's new domestic social contract with capital and labor be. And I am empathetic, though not into the same degree of passion as the caller, that we need to rethink where manufacturing exists in our economy.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show.
I would like to put a little different perspective on the table. I think it's a mistake to think that the American manufacturing sector is shrinking. We have the largest and the most sophisticated manufacturing sector in the world. What is shrinking is employment in manufacturing. And I think the challenge that China faces or presents to us is the need to upgrade our labor force to move in directions where we have actually greater value added per person to justify higher incomes. And this requires all kinds of reforms that are currently on the table, whether it's portable health care, whether it's pension systems that are portable. It has to do with retraining, not just underfunded programs if there's some sort of trade disturbance to an employment pattern, but the disturbance is really from modernization, from technical change. And if we don't really adjust our whole economic dynamic to the kinds of challenges that will come not just from China, but from India and other economies as well, then we'll be left behind and we will be bitterly blaming others who are actually working hard to improve their lives for what we see as an unfair system. I think the exchange rate issue that Steve has just mentioned has been an exaggerated bête noire in this whole discussion when the real reason for China's global trade surplus. I don't want to talk about the bilateral balance with the U.S. That's really not important. China has such big deficits with other countries. We need to look at its global trade balance. And that only really became large because, as Steve earlier said, we exported such a surge of buying power to the world, including to China and also to our own real estate sector, that the Chinese were then pushed into a trade surplus situation they didn't want when they had to fight the inflation. So I would really not say that China is responsible for the divides of the American manufacturing system. We have a responsibility to respond to the normal aspirations and hard labor of countries around the world that want to move into sectors in ways that we did a long time ago.
We're almost out of time. I'd like to talk briefly about President Obama's trip to China. He plans to go there before the end of the year. Stapleton Rory, what do you expect to happen on this journey?
The trip is what we in diplomacy call an action-forcing event. Because both sides want the trip to produce positive results, the fact that the trip is going to take place means that the bureaucracies in both countries will be working overtime to try to come up with deliverables that can result from the visit.
Things you can announce with a lot of...
Things you can announce.
Right. So what kinds of things might be possible?
Well, some progress on the climate change issue is one possibility. Dealing finding common measures we can take to get us out of the economic downturn. Both of us want to cooperate in doing that. The president cited that as the number one priority in his remarks to the bilateral dialogue. There could be science and technology cooperation. Clean energy is an area where there's possible, and there are other dialogue areas.
There are also likely to be large Chinese purchases of American products if they're if they're successful in this. China's trade surplus, by the way, has evaporated pretty much. It's really dropped to about a quarter of what it was a year ago.
Albert Keitel, Stephen Clemens, and Stapleton Roy, I want to thank you for being with us this hour on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks so much, Diane. Susan. Great
thank
pleasure.
You. Mm-hmm.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.